So are we ready to start, Trini?
Yeah.
So wait.
Oh, yeah, okay. You have
I'm the moderator, yeah. I'm Tony Leonard. I'm going to talk about lessons from inhomogeneous turbulence and a few other things. But we're going to go back to 1956 to get started. And this is a nice little article by Phillips. Is that what?
Was that before you were born?
No, no.
What you supposed to say? Which month?
That was before I was into fluid mechanics. But so if you have a patch of vorticity in an infinite domain,
Well done, Bill.
That's good. That's okay. So this is just to, I think this, yeah, we can go a little bit more. Okay. Okay. So this is the story when you have a patch of vorticity that's has compact support, but otherwise infinite domain. Then you can expand the exponential function that defines the Fourier transform of the vorticity, and you get, for example, if you look at the first term is integral of omega dx, that's equal to zero. The second term could be zero, or it may not be zero. And it all depends on whether or not there is net momentum or net impulse in this patch of vorticity. And that is an invariant of the viscous flow, so whatever impulse you start with, you have forever. And why is this interesting? Well, if you look at the scalar energy spectrum function, that's just the integral of this omega squared over all angles in k-space. And so the result is that if you do have non-zero impulse to start with and forever, same value I, you get a k-squared dependence for low k with a constant C1 independent of time, and you get for final period of decay you get a t to the minus 3/2. And if you have zero impulse, then you get, then this term is zero, so that means that the leading order expansion for omega k is k squared. So this squared is k-fourth, and so you get a k-fourth behavior, which I believe this C2 can, it could be time-dependent because there is some dynamics that can take place. But anyway, you get a k-fourth behavior, and final period of k is t to the minus 5/2. 3.
There's no assumption, there's no linearization.
No.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, see? That's right.
No, why, how did you come to believe final phase requires linearization?
Well, it's assumption that people usually make when they look at the final period. But well, now wait a minute. This assumption it was made here too.
Yeah.
He discusses this whole thing, but it's a linearization in the end. Yes, sorry, it's final period, so there is linearization.
Where?
No, no, but right here.
No, final period is dominating.
Yeah. It's linearized. Oh, yes, yes. No, but No, this is true for all time. This is true in the, at the end, this bottom stuff. So I think we're mixing two things. This is true for all time. This is true at the end, and that's the linear. So this doesn't depend on linearization, but this does. Okay.
The power in T at final period.
Yes.
Is not changed by linearity.
I don't know about that. I think that would be hard to prove, wouldn't it? you may. This guy. You say that sarcastically, or okay. I'm sorry. I'm the moderator. Yeah.
I think they're usually bounds on the decay. They put some limits on the decay. But
okay.
I'm not sure what they are. They're probably maybe they're 3 halves and that's a limit or something. It has to be faster than 3 halves.
Yeah.
She is going to talk about that a little bit, aren't you? No.
I don't believe it's
theory. Oh, you don't believe it's theory. Okay.
Let's prove that last week's speculation.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, for example, if you look at a vortex ring all by itself, and integrate over, take the Fourier transform, integrate over all angles, you can see that you get a k-squared low wave number dependence, and then you get some oscillations due to the sort of the curvature of the filament, and then those kind of die out, and you get a k to the minus 1. Then if you have a finite core to this vortex ring, that'll peel off and give you an integrable energy spectrum. If you assume that you have an exact delta function filament, of course that has infinite energy content, and that just keeps going. So going from let's see. So there are we were encouraged to talk about alternate ways to compute the Navier-Stokes equations, and I guess Shi Yi is going to talk about the Lattice-Boltzmann method a little bit. The vortex method attempts to solve the vorticity transport equation, and if you're very poor in resources, or if you started in the 70s, you would stick with just a small collection of vortex filaments, and that, admittedly, that's just a model of the Navier-Stokes equations. That the best you could hope for, I would imagine, is that you get some kind of large-scale dynamics about right. So this is moving from 1956 to 1976. This is something I played with. It's 1978, it says. You can start with just a small collection of little loops, sort of elliptical loops of vorticity, and let them kind of interact. And they produce lots of nice little twists and turns and so forth. And if you look at the curvature and the torsion functions on these curves, they look pretty exotic. Not sure they mean much. Looks like some of the, kind of the high Reynolds number data that Srini gets. Okay. But you can, if you do stop this computation at a certain time and you scale your energy spectrum, you have a couple of constants you can play with to try to fit a comp below in Corson, for example. You can sort of get something that looks pretty good. fact, it's better than that because I... So this is five filaments, about 400 node points. And at time zero, this is the energy spectrum function. Some later time, it's like this.
And how are the scales of these vortex filaments distributed?
I just have a computational diameter and so forth, and I can fix what I can play with is the circulation. I can crank the circulation up and down because that just changes my time scale, and I can have a free scale parameter to play with. So, in other words, I can move the thing this way. I can move this spectrum this way and this way, but I'm not I'm not pushing this as a yeah, right. Do I hear no. Dean Chapman? All right. This little inside Ames joke. It's about 150 R lambda. So now, now there's a kind of a lot of effort to try to push just little particles of vorticity, and large numbers of these particles that overlap and produce kind of realistic vorticity fields, and actually putting in the viscous terms, and those are coming along pretty well because of these so-called fast vortex algorithms and lots of nice ways to remesh. You still have a Lagrangian mesh to worry about. And the Lagrangian meshes have a typical problem. They get stretched in one direction, crunched in the other. And so you do have to remesh these things. And that's kind of an art. And I might be able to show you some of that tomorrow if I couldn't find it for today. There's another little application of vortex dynamics that I've been playing with in the last couple of years, and that's to look at the evolution of tiny little spots of vorticity. And here we can, I know the rapid distortion theory has a bad name, but here we can at least start out with rapid distortion theory because these little things are so small that we can get away with it. So this is just to see what happens if you have a tiny little, say, blob of vorticity. In this case, I just picked a so-called spherical vortex ring, which is just the curl of a Gaussian function. And A would be proportional to the impulse vector. And so this satisfies the divergence condition. And you can study what happens to this thing in the surroundings of some kind of large-scale turbulence. And again, you use the linear evolution equation for this guy, at least for a while. But notice, even though it's extremely small, it still has a k-squared component at small k. I mean, there's nothing you can do to get rid of that. Just because it's small doesn't mean it's all its wave numbers are at high wave number. It has wave numbers all over the place. There is a kind of a viscous cutoff at the size of the element. So it goes like k squared, and then it turns over at the size of the element. And this thing, evolves.
Most of the entropy decay is due to self-annihilation, other than
Yeah. Well, I'm assuming that the Reynolds number is extremely high, so I'm not going to worry about that just yet. But yeah, you're right. It would, if I started with a small ring at a low Reynolds number, then it would kind of just die off. Yeah, this thing doesn't. And what happens is that it actually gains impulse because it gets stretched and typically stretched in kind of a cigar shape, because there's going to be a scale, there's going to be a direction where there's most stretching, and then there's intermediate direction, and then the direction of compression. And lambda 1 is the eigenvalue, time eigenvalue for the most stretched direction. And this is not the strain rate tensor, but this is the strain tensor we're talking about here, not the strain rate tensor. And so what happens is that the initial spectrum goes like k squared and then falls off. But there's a the k squared component moves this way to lower k, but increases in amplitude because the whole thing is gaining impulse. And then there's a k to the plus 1 region for this little guy. And it turns out that this is due to the fact that the at certain scales, this thing looks like a plus minus vortex lined up with each other. So you have kind of a tube of vorticity going along the long axis, and then a return tube, and two tubes that are next to each other produce a kind of a k to the plus 1. And then finally, at high wave numbers, the thing looks like a sheet, two sheets next to each other. And so sheets give you minus 2. And but then you have to. It's a schematic, yeah.
In a space of vortices, all these vortices are azimuthal, is that correct?
Initially, they're spherical vortices with, azimuthal vorticity. But when they're stretching, this thing, this ball kind of thing, with can get stretched in any kind of any direction.
But there's no vortex stretching unless it is azimuthal.
Well, yeah, but the vorticity gets turned into the most stretched direction, so it gets more and more stretched. Yeah. So. So these things are pulling impulse out of the main flow in some way, but it's not clear how that's an interesting question in itself to me. But of course, eventually these things get long enough so that they start bending over on themselves, and so that's not a violation of RDT, but that's just a violation of the idea that there's only one strain rate, strain tensor that this object sees. It, once they get long enough, they'll start seeing different strain tensors. And then finally, there'll be some nonlinear effects if the vorticity gets strong enough. So,
is there any condition under which all those could be same?
Oh. Well, all you know is that lambda 1 is bigger than lambda 2, which is bigger than, that's all you know. Lambda 1 is the eigenvalues for the strain tensor are lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, and they sum to 0. And I've ordered them so that lambda 1 is the largest one. But otherwise, the lambda 2 at most could be equal to lambda 1, if that helps. I don't know if that helps. But. Yeah, they obviously. Yeah, they, you're right. Well, there's a factor of 2 here. 0, yeah. So. Yeah, I don't know what happens when these things become nonlinear. That's where Lundgren and his spiral, where he was able to get through that stage. And it's not obvious what happens in this case. One of the reasons I brought this up is that if you take a blob of scalar and perform the same kind of analysis, I thought it was interesting what you get out of it. You get little pack. Now you don't have to worry about nonlinearity, but you of course have to worry about the fact that a scalar packet can start getting curved and distorted, obviously. But if you don't worry about that just yet, these little scalar packets have a k squared, a k to the 1, and then a k to the 0. But the interesting thing is that, of course, the k to the 0 is, what's happening is that as this marches out to higher and higher wave number, because the scalar is getting crunched into a pancake, the level is dropping at just the right amount so that you get a 1 over k spectrum out of these things if you average over time. So, and this is, if you believe that, if you translate all of this to two-dimensional turbulence and you say you have little patches of vorticity that are so small they're not dynamically interesting, or so weak they're not dynamically interesting, but they get stretched, they produce a k to the minus 3 energy spectrum. And so that's why I brought up this comment when Jim mentioned we have to compute all the scales that are dynamically significant, and I certainly agree with that. So the question is, where does that cutoff take place? So that's one question I want to leave with people. And that may be related to this idea. Now the mathematicians can help me out on this one. I think this idea of an inertial manifold is this. This is the thing that's been shown to be rigorous in two-dimensional turbulence. No, it's not even shown to be rigorous there. Okay, forget it. The idea is this. Still open. Okay. Well, if it works, the idea is that you have M modes somehow that you have to pick that are dynamically important, and the rest of them, M plus 1 up to N, are just slaves to the first M, and that if that would be nice, especially if M is a small number. Okay. Okay. So that's all I have to say for now. I'll let... Okay. Ramifications. If there's such a thing, then all we'd need to do is compute these guys. And if you ever want to know these guys down here, you just say, okay, that's the idea. Yeah.
But you have to know that function really to compute the lower ones.
Yeah.
Or model it.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's that?
Tamam,
yeah.
That's the one of the equations. There's some 2D reaction fusion equations for which this has been rigorously established. So I seem to remember something of this that along these lines, and the claim was made, I don't know how rigorous it was, that you know, where those modes cut off was once you're well past home book.
Yeah, if that's true, then it's not very useful. Although Heinz Kreis, I don't know if people have seen. I saw some of his stuff a year ago, and it may be he did some numerical experiments. I believe it was 2D turbulence, where he did I don't know, 200 by 200. And then he did the same experiment over again where he zeroed out, zeroed everything down to the first 100 by 100 and zeroed out the rest of the modes. But he kept the information on the first 100 by 100 and made them do what they did in the first case. And sure enough, all the other modes came back and produced the right answer, at least looking at the results. So maybe that's not so surprising. But if you know exact, so the message is, if you know exact dynamics of the large scales, small scales will fill in. Yeah, right. So. Yeah.
That's exactly the opposite of the way we started this. Where the proposal by the speakers was that if you know the small scale, the large scale.
Yeah, right. Right. That was Ron Adrian, right?
No, it was, I'm thinking specifically of Prakash.
Oh, you mean the. The first week of the conference?
He wouldn't make that statement.
No. He would
say that if we understand the statistics of the small scale, that we should be able to work up to the large scale. Yeah, we think that's the reason. He would even claim that he does know how to statistics.
Because, in closure, he's really doing something like that. If you know the statistics of U prime, V prime, bar, you can work out the what U average. So
you're still going to solve that equation for me.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Any more comments? We have lots of time, but we can go ahead. You're next, aren't you?
I can feel the audience.
Yeah.
Physical picture. I feel like that's where I'm stuck. I think completing a lot of statistical features. We start with a large number of complex spherical vortices, right?
Right.
And then what we finally get. Can you give a picture?
Sure.
Hello.
He left. Oh, he's here. They thought you left. Okay. So this thing has a longest scale, and then if you cut through the middle, you get something that looks like a little bit like this. So this would be a plus and a minus. So this would be the smallest scale this way, and this would be the intermediate scale this way. Well, that's generically what it looks like. And of course, sometime you have to give up on this whole thing because either the non-localness of the strain is getting you, or the non-linearity of the dynamics will start to do something. Or the viscous effects will kill the whole thing. But the viscous effects are easy in RDT. You can put them in, but the rest of it, not so good. Okay.